sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
JCPenney going out of business sale. Impasse with the debt ceiling debate is going on. Stocks break a three-week winning streak. And our guest is Tom McClellan, a great guest to have. And we have all sorts of things to talk about going into the last week of September on episode number 332 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, Andrew Horowitz here, and welcome aboard to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. So we talk about investing here. We kind of cover the more serious side of investing if you want a little lighter and more jovial and comic relief style show. Check out DH Unplugged. Talk with John Dvorak each and every week. Comes out on Wednesday mornings, first thing, and we cover some topics that are really strange. But we also talk about some business in a different light and break things apart from a couple of different angles. I'm sort of the guy that brings the ideas, the concepts, and the discussion. And John, being the curmudgeon that he is, he brings the other side to the discussion. It's quite a lively hour that we spend together, and I think that you'll really enjoy it. By the way, just to let you know how it started was that we had been talking on the phone for, I don't even know how long it was, and over a period of about a year, and we became friends, phone buddies, and one day John says, you know, I think a lot of people would like to listen to what we're talking about. I said, really? That's kind of creepy. What do you mean? And he says, well, I think that we could do a podcast and just have this kind of discussions that we're having now and have it in a podcast format. And I said, I don't know if that's really going to go over. He said, I'm telling you, I've done this a long time. It's going to go over. So several years back, we started, and it's grown very nicely. We have a rather sizable audience, and hopefully you will see what everybody else likes about it, and I would encourage you to do so over at DH Unplugged. And by the way, right now we're having the DH Unplugged Closest to the Pin contest, where you guess the price of a stock, and there's prizes and all that. So just go over to dhunplugged.com, check it out, and you can see what's going on there. Let's talk about some of the things that are going on. We see that the markets have broken a three-week winning streak. They tried desperately to stay up there, and every time there was a dip down pretty deep, there was a buyer seemingly ready to pick up some of the positions, whether it was individually or maybe even the futures, because it was a battle. It was a battle. And a lot of the things that are going on, at least from the aspect of what you see in the news, is that the budget impasse, the whole debt ceiling issue, the whole idea that Obamacare may be defunded or not, or pushed back or not. You know, over the weekend, there's a lot of movement of discussion. A lot of it happened actually on social networks. You saw that there was the various aides of politicians on Twitter coming out with commentary. I don't know how I feel about that, honestly. I don't know if that's something that I'm in favor of, this whole idea of getting the public all involved, or I don't know. It's just something about it is, you know, we hire you. That's what we do. We hire the politicians that we believe are going to do the right thing on our behalf. And the majority wins, obviously, and they are put into Congress or the president or whatever, you know, particular local venue that is being with the elections for. And now we have to get it back into our face about what do we want to do? What's the point? Why don't we just have a majority vote on everything and be done with it? Be a lot quicker, be a lot less salaries, a lot less discussion that we'll be having on an elongated period. And probably, I would say definitely, not probably, definitely, there would be less delay. You have a date that the vote comes up. You have the vote that happens. And if you don't like the outcome, well, it's too bad. It's majority rules. And then well, you'll just have to make sure that you encourage people that you know that are on your side to vote. And that's going to be a great little way of doing things. And anyway, with that, we are seeing a lot of volatility in markets, a lot of concern around the world, even though we did see the Russell 2000 small caps hit an all-time high last week. We saw the Dow get hurt a bit, about 1%, the S&P as well. And we did see some global markets not doing as well during the period. You know, the hope is that there's still a lot of stimulus by the Fed. And now the word is that Janet Yellen is going to be the new Fed chair. And that has not been officially announced yet, but that's seemingly being passed around. And there is word that there is a discussion going on behind the scenes with the White House and various people in Congress that is saying, hey, you know, if you have any issues now, if you have any things that you want to talk about, if you have any problems with Janet Yellen, do me a favor, tell me now so that we can make this whole process somewhat easy. Because the president appoints, of course, the Fed chair. Now, Janet Yellen, if you don't know who that is, Janet Yellen is now the second behind Bernanke at the Fed. And by all accounts, she is rather dovish. Now, dovish, if you don't know what that means, basically there's a phrase that you use in terms of easy or tight monetary policy. It also goes hand in hand with inflation. When you call someone a dove, it's not a negative, it's just a figure of speech and what we use to describe a particularly a person who is particularly okay with utilizing things like stimulus and monetary policy and quantitative easing, who really is not looking at the inflation as a problem and doesn't really come up with any kind of negative statements when they're using excessive means of monetary policy. Dovish is saying, you know what, we think that the economy is not so good and we should be using some more stimulus and inflation is kind of in check. Now, on the other side, you call somebody a hawk when they are out to stomp out inflation, when they're looking to pull back the reins of the Fed and really restrict any kind of monetary stimulus. So you have a hawkish statement, maybe a dovish statement, someone who acts in a dovish manner when it comes to the Fed, etc. Or you could just label them a dove or a hawk. Well, Janet Yellen is, by all accounts, like I said, a dove. But also, from what I've seen, read, and researched, Janet Yellen is probably more dovish than Bernanke. Janet Yellen will probably opt for more stimulus for an elongated period of time than Bernanke ever would. You know, if you say Helicopter Ben just throwing money all over the place, we're talking about a spaceship Yellen, where she's just going to continue with the monetary policy for a very long time. And with that in mind, a lot of people are very concerned about inflation, rightfully so. But here's something interesting. The conversation we had with Ambrose last week on the podcast, if you didn't listen to that, I really encourage you to listen to that because there were some extremely good points that he made, as well as some of the content I found was just superb from him, not from me. You know, I just asked the questions. But one of the things that he mentioned, and we talked before and after the actual discussion that we had on the episode, was about how will we ever get out of this? Will the Fed actually stop printing new money and buying bonds? How's that going to work? How do you get out of this? And if they do stop, how are they ever going to unwind the bonds that they have? Well, he made some very good points. And I thought that was, as a matter of fact, they were really good points. And one of the things he said was they're never going to unwind the bonds they own. What they're going to do is probably what's happened in other places is they stop paying interest on or stop accepting interest from the government, and that's okay. And eventually, over time, the bonds kind of disappear. They just go away for one reason or another. They're just, poof, gone. And that's the way we extinguish debt internally. Now, it's a different story when you have debt outstanding, whether it's for China or Japan or Europe or individuals, hedge funds, etc. I'm talking about the internal transaction between the Fed and the Treasury, if you will. So I would listen to that. I think it's really interesting. And that's why it's possible that inflation won't really kick up. But again, it seems almost improbable that there won't be inflation due to the fact that there is such an incredible amount of monetary stimulus going on, and the fact that the rates are so low right now and probably will be this way for some time to come. We're also seeing that other countries around the world are doing this same concept of looking to devalue their money, and some of them call it devaluation, some call it maybe low interest rates. Well, Vietnam is planning to devalue their dong by about 2% by the end of this month, and maybe even by the end of this year, depending on how things go, because they're looking to make their economy much more competitive. Now, we talked about when Japan had that monstrous monetary stimulus, how that was going to affect all the countries in the Asia area, because now the competition has shifted dramatically. When they beat down their currencies by 15% in Japan, how are the other countries going to really compete with that? Well, we see that there is these types of things going on. This will be the second devaluation by Vietnam. And, you know, those things are painful, but they're also beneficial. And that's the whole game that's going on right now. Now, speaking about games, we have to bring up JCPenney. That was the most ridiculous maneuvering that I've ever seen. And obviously the stock took it on the chin, because the realization of what was happening and what did occur finally was out there. Basically, if you didn't pay attention to this, I'll tell you, here's what happened. So JCPenney comes out with a comment on, I believe it was Thursday, or maybe it was the day before. The end of the week last week, the CEO of JCPenney, Ullman, came out and said that there was no need for cash, even though there were some rumors out there that they had some need to build some more money into their balance sheet for having some liquidity, et cetera. But no. There's no need, at least for this year, for any cash. Now, Goldman comes out with a note afterwards and says, no need. Nope. They don't need right now. Sometime in the future, they maybe will need something. But as things stand right now, there's no need for any kind of cash infusion, cash raise, et cetera. The next day, or at the close of the market, really, after the close of the market on Thursday, wouldn't you know it, JCPenney comes out with, I think it's an 84 million share secondary. And who is it done through? Give you a guess. Go ahead, think about it. Yep. Goldman. That's right. Goldman comes out with they come out with a secondary for JCPenney, and they're looking to raise a pretty sizable amount of money. And this is on the heels of just the day before the commentary and the write-up that they don't need any. Now, this is really a big question. There was some talk about, oh, it was planned. You know what? It doesn't matter. The fact is they were untruthful and divisive in their conversation. And that showed up with the fact that even though they were offering, and I think a 965, the stock closed down significantly lower by the close. Because people are saying, wait a minute, what else don't we know? We got major hedge funds leaving. We got change of CEO. We got comments coming out that we need money. No, we don't need money. And then we do need money. And then you see the CFO is leaving and another manager is leaving. And things are not looking very good right there. The problem is that now they set the stage for a major run on the stock, because they don't have a lot of shareholder confidence by any means. They don't have investor confidence. And now what they did, on top of the problems of the hedge funds fleeing, is that while there was the potential to have very little overhead now so that the stock could stabilize, which it looked like it did for a few days there, now who wants to own this? Who knows if they're going to get a write down on their credit? Or at least a markdown by the rating agencies. And at this point, they're going to be squeezed. Now, the stock could move around. You know, the next thing you'll probably hear is they're going to go private or some other thing just to try to keep the stock up. But at the same time, the confidence has barely been broken here. Now, BlackBerry's different. You know, BlackBerry is just a stock that is hurting terribly. They've come out with some things. that they're going to go private, and somebody says they have an offer in, and you know, there really was no substantiation and anything really backing this up. But at the same time, it's a different situation. They didn't really come out and, well, flagrantly, do we say lie, or do we say misspeak, or, you know, circumvent the truth? I don't know what you call it, but it doesn't make for a good feeling of owning that stock. We don't own the stock, but we did look at it as an idea, actually, in Trigger Point Research as a breaking up after a bounce, and we closed the position time ago because it just wasn't holding. And right now, whether or not the shorts are going to be really attacking it or whether the longs are just going to be moving out of it, again, the support is just not there. Now, what I want to talk about, because I think is going to be very important coming up, is the whole idea that, hey, wait a minute, we still don't know exactly what's going on with this whole debt ceiling debate. Now, I think we'll know more about it as the time clock ticks away and it gets closer and closer, and we'll have a little bit more detail, because it appears to me that the Congress is deathly afraid of markets. So whether it's, you know, at the 9th hour, 10th hour, 11th hour, somewhere before the end of September, only a day or so now, we're going to see some kind of agreement. Now, President Obama came on the TV on 3:30 on Friday and said that this is not up for debate. He held his ground. This is something that, you know, shouldn't be done. There should be not a debate about this. There is no one that should be allowed to play with the rating and the quality of U.S. The rating. You know, this is just absurd. He hasn't, as far as I can see, he hasn't winced. That's okay. But on the other hand, you got these Republicans that, I guess, in their back pocket, they had this whole idea that they're going to try to defund Obamacare, and this is one of the ways they're going to try to do it, by pressuring the whole idea of throwing the markets into disarray, and also by, quote-unquote, shutting down the government. You know, usually, historically, we've seen that there has been a market that is rather choppy when these things happen. But if you look back in history, there was a study done by Capital IQ and looks at past performance of a similar situation in the 1995-1996 government shutdown. And during the shutdown, there was about a 4% drop in the S&P 500. Now, once that shutdown was alleviated, so there was a period about 1 month up until and during the shutdown, but once that was alleviated and there was actually a bill passed and funding was done, the markets actually went up 10% the next month. That's pretty interesting. Now, is that going to happen? I'm not saying that's going to happen, but what I think is really interesting about that is that you have this this fear that goes on. The fact of the matter is that in terms of government shutdowns, in terms of this impasse that's going to happen, there's going to be eventually some type of agreement. Now, maybe it's going to be that one side just totally gives in. One side just, you know, says, okay, we got our way, great. The other side, or the other potential thing that's going to happen, is it will be elongated. Now, that won't be good. The longer it goes on, the more uncertainty there is, the more investor sentiment wanes, and you know, just get this real mess going on. But the bottom line is that it will get solved. And usually what happens is that, again, you get this sell-off. Now, I think investors are a little bit more used to the situation, since we've had several similar types of occurrences over the last several years. And therefore, the sell-off that you would have seen is going to be a bit muted unless we get into this elongated period of negotiation, debate, and an ongoing problem for a period of weeks. But I wouldn't worry too much about it. As a matter of fact, if you remember, the last time that the U.S., our U.S. government bonds were downgraded, it was actually really good for U.S. government bonds, as strange as that is. And you saw that there was a significant move of markets. So again, I don't find that to be too much of a problem. I want to tell you a couple other things that are going on, and then we will have some things about an IPO that's coming up that I think is just really funny. One of the things I wanted to mention was that if you look at the JP Morgan situation, you know, JP Morgan is being fined, and they're looking like they're going to have to pay upwards of $11 billion. Now, we put a poll out and a question out on the disciplinedinvestor.com last week, and we talked about, okay, here's five or six different countries, and here's their GDP. What does that equal? Well, you look at the entire annual GDP of several countries, and that equals the one payment, the fine that J.P. Morgan's going to have to pay. But if you notice, J.P. Morgan stock has come down a bit, but it hasn't really been just obliterated. $11 billion is not a small number. Now, you look at the on the other side, this is really interesting. On Friday, before the market opened, there was an investigation into Lumber Liquidators. That symbol, LL. And Lumber Liquidators, it seems that the case against them is that they've been using some wood for the various flooring, etc., that may be from an area that is where a protected species of, I think it was tiger, is, I think the Siberian tiger, lives. And they're using some of the wood from trees, etc. And there's going to be a problem with that. So now you have a company who possibly is using some bad wood. And they may be fined for that. Or they may obviously not be able to use that anymore. So they'll go to an alternative source. Stock is down 11% on the news. This is stock that has great earnings growth. Balance sheet is in good shape. Sales have been growing very nicely. And recently came out with an earnings report that was just fantastic. And an outlook that was really good. And what's happening is the stock gets cut down by 11%. Now contrast that to what's going on with J.P. Morgan, and I think it's kind of funny. And you would say, well, J.P. Morgan, the size of them, the revenues they make, and the ratio of what they make compared to what Lumber Liquidators make. Yeah, I got that. I understand that. But to not budge the stock of J.P. Morgan on an $11 billion fine compared to an 11% drop in Lumber Liquidators, you have to scratch your head a little bit. And truthfully, I don't think this headline of Lumber Liquidators is that impressive in terms of really whacking the stock. On that news, because we have had that stock before, we sold it, and we bought some of the stock back, and it was up nicely by the end of the day from the price that we bought it at. I think it ended up only down 4.5% or maybe 5%, which, again, don't forget, we had a very weak tape on Friday. So you could have that in any particular day with or without the news. So those are the things we're kind of looking for, some of these really crazy news stories that whack stocks down and make a situation where you see much more selling pressure over ridiculous news. So that's a couple of things. I also want to mention, very important before we get to our guest, webinar. We have a Trigger Charts webinar coming up. We did one for TradeStation last week for the all the people over at that have TradeStation directly with TradeStation. TradeStation actually hosted a webinar for us and put it on with their clients. And we're going to do one that's really neat coming up this week on the 2nd at 11:30 a.m. October 2nd at 11:30 a.m. It's free. We're going to talk about autopilot. This is our algo trading strategy that gives you very easy to understand buy and sell signals on any security. So if you ever looked for one of those very easy to interpret, it's essentially color-coded, buy, sell, you know, stop out or take profits, this is really neat. You want to spend some time doing this. So go over to triggercharts.com and just click on the events and reserve your spot. Really neat. We'll go live at 11:30 and take your questions, et cetera, and go through it. So I really want you to be there for that. It's going to be very interesting. And we're here with Tom McClellan, and he's, of course, with McClellan Financial Publications, one of the great keepers of statistics in the markets. And we're going to talk about a lot of things. By the way, I just want to mention, because sometimes I do this at the end, I want to mention that some of the things that are available through Tom is, you can get a free trial of his daily edition, and that's pretty cool. You get a 14-day free trial. But Tom, I just want to mention that because sometimes I wait till the end. I thought I'd just mention it for you in the beginning because it's great stuff. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well.
So I want to talk to you about a variety of things because I'm not sure where to start. I have a whole list of things, but you wrote a lot of, you have a chart and focus that you put out regularly each week. And one of the things that really caught my eye recently was the 60-year cycle for interest rates. And I was kind of hoping that you'd explain it a little bit and, you know, tell us what it's saying to you, what you can infer from that.
Well, most of us who are trading today remember The mortgage rates getting up into the high teens back in about 1980, and so a lot of people think of that as the normal place where interest rates are going to have to go back to. History shows that that was a really aberrant time period, and that even though interest rates are likely to rise between now and about 2040, because of that 60-year cycle, we're not likely to see the 80s style mortgage rates again. But we've tracked it back to the 1700s using some really old historical data that was assembled once upon a time by an organization known as the Foundation for the Study of Cycles. That was started by a guy named Edward Dewey, who was a statistician that had been tasked by the Roosevelt administration in the 30s to try to figure out why the crash had occurred. And so he did a bunch of cyclical analysis, gathered a bunch of data, went on to create an organization known as the Foundation for the Study of Cycles that did a lot of great work over the years. But using that data, we can see pretty clearly that there is about a 60-year turning point pattern in interest rates using corporate bond yields, because we haven't always had the same sort of federal treasury debt issued that we have now. But there has been corporate bonds traded actively back to the 1700s, pretty much like today. So we can use that data as a good proxy, and you can see it. And there are times where it goes off track a little bit. When we had the Civil War in the 1860s, that threw a loop into the interest rate curve, and when we had the Mexican War in the 1840s, that got it a little bit off track. But once those were resolved, it got back on track, and you can still see it. Best thing to do is for people to go to mcoscillator.com and look at our Learning Center, and you can see all the Chart and Focus articles and see the chart better than I can describe it on the radio here.
Now, the thing is that, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion, obviously, about what if, and the focus on the Fed, in my opinion, I've talked about this probably too many times for my listeners to even, dare say bring it up again, but the whole focus on the Fed, which is, in my opinion, outrageous at this point, between radio, television, and print, there is, it's more than obsession and fascination. It's an absolute, it's like the only thing that anybody cares about in terms of the news. And a matter of fact, we saw a lot of movement recently with the bond yields that when even the talk about, slightly moving out, just possibly, we'll see. And, we saw a big move in the 10-year and other terms. But you said in the beginning that we're likely to see a bond situation where we have maybe the teens again. I mean, what kind of thing could be bringing that on?
No, I'm saying that we're not likely to
have interest rates go
back up into the teens like we saw in the 70s and 80s. That was really an aberration in history. We are likely to see higher rates than now, which, you just can't help but have higher rates than now, since, when you're on the floor, you can only go up. But that's likely to persist between now and about the year 2040. When you're talking about a 60-year cycle, you don't want to try to pick the exact date. Roughly between now and 2040, the direction for interest rates should be higher. And it won't be linearly higher. It'll be in a wiggly move, like every trend is in the markets. But we can just generally count on that. And some of the research I've been doing recently offers a possible explanation for why that 60-year cycle in interest rates exists, and it's likely tied to cycles of the sun and the sun's output that changes global temperatures. It's becoming a big piece of news lately that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change at the UN can't really explain why we've had a cooling trend for the last 15 years, and it's because the sun is calming down. The sunspot numbers are much lower. There's just less solar output. And what that does when you have a cooling period, like it comes along every about 60 years, it tends to be inflationary. With less solar output, you get less crop yields, so higher food prices, and therefore higher everything else prices. And that inflation tends to make people expect higher interest rates on their investments. And that is the likely explanation. We unfortunately don't have that many solar cycles worth of data to go back and really test this. But it happens to match for all the data that we have thus far on both interest rates and sunspots and global temperatures. And it's a fascinating new area to look at, to think that, gosh, if global warming stops, as it appears to have done for the last 15 years, that may not be a good thing for investors and for the marketplace and for the economic health of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was having a hard time connecting the spot dots, if you will, where the, you know, how is it that anything related to the sun or cosmically could really affect investments? It was a kind of a little bit of a bridge, but I guess now that you're saying that there is something to do with the warmth of the planet and the cooling and the temperature overall, and then the potential for droughts and or not, and the potential for rain or not, et cetera. I mean, I could see how that could then obviously plug into the whole idea of food. You know, we didn't have as much years and years ago. We didn't have as much of a expense for energy, right? I mean, going back 200, 300 years, there wasn't that much of a cost, because you'd go get your own firewood and you'd, you know, have a horse.
But you had to spend a lot of your time doing that 300 years ago. People would spend a lot of their day just working in the fields and getting food and getting the firewood and hauling it by wagon into the cities. It was a much more difficult time. A lot more time and energy was spent on food and energy provision years ago than is the case today.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't know that back in the beginnings of the personal consumption expenditures data back in the 40s, people used to spend a whole lot more on food as a percentage of their total expenditures than they do now. Food costs have really gone down. Energy costs have really gone down. They've gone up in nominal terms. You know, we're $110 a barrel for oil, but in terms of what it used to cost compared to, you know, the value of the dollar and how much we had to spend to get around and do anything, we're living in wonderful times now.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you, because it's a time factor also. We're using money to pay for it rather than our time and our own personal energy and efforts to do it. Yeah, I agree with that. That makes a lot of sense. So a couple other things that I wanted to focus in on is, now when the McClellan Oscillator, we talk about this quite regularly, you and I, and you know, you're always looking for the potential for an extreme zone, right? That's really kind of one of the best keys to see, you know, maybe a reversal or possibly a trend that's happening. And then there's the idea of utilizing the, you know, how much and how complex is the pattern above or below, et cetera. Now, we've recently seen back in June and August, I believe, two very significant moves to the downside in a very oversold reading. Some of the largest negative readings that we've had in a long time, right?
That's true.
And then we saw from there pretty much somewhat of a V-shape on each of those, where there was a rebound and there was a swift move up. The high didn't get to the extreme levels of the lows, you know, comparatively. And we're seeing that happen two or three times, and now we're back within the range of, we'll call it neutral. Would that be a reasonable thing to say?
Yeah, and we should lay a little bit of groundwork for your listeners to talk about what the McClellan Oscillator really is. It was an indicator created by my parents back in 1969, and you can think of it as an accelerometer on the advanced decline statistics. So every day we know that a certain number of stocks went up and a certain number of stocks went down. When you look at the difference between those every day, that gives you information, especially if you can aggregate it over time. So when you get a very high positive McClellan Oscillator reading, that means that there has been very strong positive acceleration in the advanced decline statistics. Normally, when you get the McClellan Oscillator up to a really high level, way up above 150, that is normally a sign of strong initiation of an up move, and you can expect more follow-on buying to come. We just recently saw the oscillator last week on the 18th of September. We saw it get up to plus 268. That's really, really high, and under normal conditions, one would expect that to mean that there's more upside coming. I think this time is different, and I think that the reason it's different is because the Fed is just really screwing everything up. With their announcements or their non-announcements or the money pumping that they're doing, they have become the fountain of all liquidity now. And whereas the market used to generate its own liquidity waves back and forth from the money that it had, all the marginal liquidity is coming now from the Fed or not, or we don't know. And so it's really affecting how money moves around and how people are making decisions, and it's screwing up a lot of the indicators that we follow, because we're trying to figure out, well, is the Fed going to turn off the faucet, or what is going to happen? It really makes it a much more difficult task to understand what's happening versus you know, under normal conditions, when the market's behaving like its own closed ecosystem, you have a different agent coming in and trying to control things. And the Fed is really, they are trying to control things. They want to manipulate a situation that is to their liking, as opposed to how the market would have it be. And that causes all sorts of effects that may be good or maybe not.
Well, I mean, you've tracked historically the level of QE that goes into the market and the daily buys or not buys of any bonds over time. And now obviously, it's been a little bit more regular with the $85 billion per month. And, you correlated it pretty well to how stocks have done. Now, it's interesting because that's now kind of been changed because there's a regular pump into the markets. And, the big question that I agree with you is, with all the things that are going on and, around the world with the amount of money that's been pumped in and the focus, it's more so, I think, beyond the Fed, the media has also put this in major focus. Now, whether it's because it's a fact or whether it's because it's brought about because of it's just what they believe to be the case, rather than looking at fundamentals, by the way, rather than looking at innovation, rather than looking at anything else. And as a matter of fact, the Fed is playing right into it also. It seems like the media is controlling all this because the Fed, it seems that they didn't do anything, even though there was a high expectation for it in the market because they were concerned about a variety of things, inclusive of, Syria, inclusive of the debt ceiling issue, you kind of add that up, and they're like, well, maybe we won't do it now. And they've gotten to a point, in my opinion, that's so reckless that, you have to wonder, the amount that gold moved the day that the Fed said we're not going to, was it Wednesday or Thursday? That they were, Thursday. We're not going to change the amount of purchases right now was absolutely, it was ridiculous, first of all, and it was amazing, second of all. I mean, it popped, $60?
It's all been given back out of gold.
Right.
And the stock market has also given back all those gains and more. And I think that we have more of a decline as the market, as investors get over watching and waiting for the Fed to do whatever they're going to do, and we allow the normal seasonal tendency of September and October to start getting some traction. And the farther that you wander off track when you're supposed to be having a normal seasonal slowdown and you instead pop higher, well, you got to unwind all that, and so we're in the process of doing that.
So let's go talk about gold, because you said the gold has a 13 and a half month cycle, okay? And it is the cycle that is kind of odd because you got this half in there. How does that come about?
Well, it's a cycle that produces important bottoms in gold prices roughly about every 13 and a half months. Since the 1990s, we've tracked it all the way back that far, and I call it a Bactrian cycle. A Bactrian camel is a two-hump camel, because it's somewhere in the middle between those important 13 and a half month cycle bottoms. There's a less important bottom in the middle. We call it the mid-cycle low. So you have a hump on the left side and a hump on the right side, and important lows every 13 and a half months. The last one was due in May. And they don't always come in exactly when they're supposed to, because the market is not a machine that works perfectly. It arrived in late June, but it did come, and we got a nice up move off that. So sometime between May of 2013 about June to July of 2014, when the next low is due, we should expect to have a rising market and a pair of nice-looking tops, and then somewhere in the middle there, we should expect to have a mid-cycle low. I can't describe it more accurately than that without a chart in front of me, but people can see it in our work. The important thing about how that cycle works is that the arrangement of the left hump and the right hump and the price peaks tells you about what's happening in the future. On the most recent cycle, before this new one started, after the June low, the right hump was lower than the left hump. In other words, it was trending downward. When that happens, you generally get a much more severe decline into the important cycle low. So how we arrange those humps on this current cycle will tell us about what gold's going to do, how deep it may have to correct in the middle of 2014. But it's a normal process that gold goes through. Gold never moves in a straight line for very long, and so you have these cyclical up and down moves that if you can anticipate it and understand it, you can make a profit from trading it.
I mean, it's been very wild and very loosely trading. When you see that kind of move, and whether it's because there was a lot of shorts on one side expecting something, or whatever else it may have been, because really, I mean, the dollar did come down significantly, but we're not seeing the same correlations that we've seen before. You know, you track this. I mean, bonds and stocks are correlated in a very strange way these days.
Back in the 1990s, the bond prices and stock prices used to move together. What we've gotten used to for the last 5 or 6 years is bond prices and stock prices on any given day doing the exact opposite of each other. To say what the normal relationship is, it's a kind of a meaningless way to describe things, because there isn't a normal relationship, or what's normal changes, and so you just have to adapt to what's happening now.
But doesn't it seem like that more so lately that in general, this is a general statement, but when I say all assets seem to rise or drop at the same time. Now, gold's been on the opposite side of that a little bit, but generally speaking, it's like, you know, everybody's buying or they're selling.
We really saw that a lot back in 2008, and that's a long time ago in stock market terms, but the housing bubble had burst and people knew that. The stock market had topped, and so suddenly in 2008, commodity index funds became the hot thing. And so you'd have huge hedge funds moving a bunch of money into the entire basket of commodities all at once and then out all at once. And so you saw correlations among all the different types of commodities really getting much stronger. Ordinarily, there isn't a really good reason for why wheat prices and copper prices should move together, because they're totally different items with totally different uses. But when you get money moving into them and out of them en masse because of that commodity indexing issue that we saw in 2008, then you can get correlations going up like that. That kind of fell out of fashion when oil prices crashed from 145 to 35 in about 5 months, and commodity indexing index funds had their day in the sun, and then people got out of them and hadn't gone into it as much. But there is still some of that money that moves from hedge funds into and out of asset classes all at once. And to the extent that that happens, you can see that kind of correlation behavior changing and acting strange.
Mm. Yeah, it is a bit strange. It's almost, and then, you know, don't forget we have the high frequency trading, also the big investigation into, that will yield nothing, by the way, in my opinion, but the investigation into how milliseconds before the announcement by the Fed, there was a gigantic, enormous buy into a variety of asset classes, inclusive of gold. And whether or not somebody tripped and hit some button, or whether or not their clock was off, they were planning on buying it too, no matter what happened, or whatever else the deal was, if there was some unscrupulous activity where data somehow, milliseconds before, by the way, which is bizarre, milliseconds before was transferred to someone and they acted upon it. You know, the whole idea of it is much different than days before, where, you know, there was this idea that, you know, the quickest you can get data would be the next day in the paper. You know, the average person.
Mm-hmm.
And things are moving much more rapidly these days. And I think that, does that make your job a little bit more difficult with statistics or no?
The markets are constantly changing. So you're always having to adapt to new conditions. I am not convinced, based on the evidence that I've seen, that there absolutely had to be a misuse of information or a miscommunication of information to lead to that funny trade that the SEC says that they're investigating. You can, there on Fed announcement days, there is all sorts of surging and pushing back and forth, and I can imagine a very innocent, in terms of informationally innocent reason for that. If you can get the market charging one way right as the announcement is coming out, then you can get the people who are trading to follow through and you know, it's like cow tipping. You just have to get the cow to start tipping a little bit, and then the gravity will take it over, and so while it may not be innocent in terms of trying to manipulate the market, it's probably not necessarily a function of somebody cheating and getting the information when they shouldn't have. It may have just been somebody trying to push the market and getting the herd to stampede one way just because the announcement was coming, and once it's out, and if they're all stampeding, then they can keep stampeding further.
Yeah, and in fact, actually, if it would have been a good idea if the Fed did come out with a cut that of their buying and the markets move down, well, you have some underlying support, like somebody said, well, it's not so bad, and then you can hold it up, rather than the idea they weren't cutting, and that just quadrupled the experience of not only buying, but everybody else pushing in and buying at the same time. So it kind of, I think, swelled, that's a very good explanation. I think it swelled the whole situation. So I appreciate that. And as I mentioned at the top of this discussion, that of course you can get a 14-day free trial of newsletters. Go over to mccl.com, right? Very.
Is that what it is? MCOscillator.com.
Yeah, I like to do that so I can get you to say it again. MCOscillator.com. Now, we're going to have those links specifically in our podcast show notes. So you can click that and go right there and get your free subscription. I love it, by the way. You know, you do a great job. I mean, you write a lot. And you do a great job of explanation, which I think is important, too, because a lot of times some of these things, when it comes to statistics, can get a little bit, get people bleary-eyed, you know, when you start looking at all the different numbers and all the things that go into something. And I think one of the things that you really excel at, Tom, is the explanation to the average daily reader of really what's going on and what it means. I think that's something very important that you do.
Well, that's nice of you to say, and I'll also let your listeners know that if they're not ready to subscribe to our paid subscription products, we have a free Chart and Focus that they can sign up and get by email. It comes out once a week. It's basically whatever chart I feel like talking about that week and a chance to look at it in depth and learn from it and see the indicators that we use. People can sign up for that. No strings attached. We won't send you a bunch of email. We won't share the list with anybody. It's just a neat way for getting more people acquainted with the indicators that we'd like to use.
I appreciate it. Hey, thanks so much for joining us today, Tom McClellan. You're great.
Great to be with you.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye. Yeah, Tom McClellan, I like that guy. He's good. Brings the facts, just the facts, and I like that. Keep the emotions out of the entire equation, and that's a good thing. All right, let's see what else we have to talk about here. Okay, now we talked about the situation with the potential for Janet Yellen coming in. Now we're going to be probably entering into a global race to the bottom. Japan is now looking to cut their corporate tax rate, and I thought that was really fascinating because there's been a lot of discussion from the rating agencies about their requirement for Japan to do something about bringing in additional revenue, and now they're actually going and cutting the tax rate and at least talking about it for corporations. Seems a bit to fly right in the face of any logic at all. And there was some funny discussion last week about when there was a press conference / dinner with Abe of Japan, the Abenomics guy, and he's talking about all sorts of things and making just funny statements that didn't translate well in English. And the funny part was what he said, because it didn't translate well, and it was comparing things that were just like, no, you don't want to compare to that. That's not a good idea. But anyway, he is very much inclined to continue with this stimulus in any manner possible. Fiscal and financial reform is something they talked about but haven't done anything about yet. Just keep on printing money. And we'll see what happens, because April is really the time period that most are looking at for Japan to be required, for lack of a better word, to do something about their income flow, their revenue flow, because they've had so many bonds that they've created and, you know, where they're going to pay for it. That's been the big discussion. Last week I mentioned that, I think it was last week, and I also mentioned on DH Unplugged that one of the stocks that we were looking at on a short basis was a company called HomeAway. Now, I like the company generally, and as a matter of fact, I use their product for a vacation home. But at the same time, there was a lot of holes in the story, and there's some concern about fraud and possibly some other types of criminal activity, I guess I would call it, that was involved, where people would put on houses onto the site. And since there was no verification requirement, well, they would get money from the would-be renter and there would never be a house actually there. So we went into a short position, a pretty sizable short position, and put some targets on it. And I got to tell you something, that moved faster than I anticipated. It was, I think, 2 days later or 3 days later, Morgan Stanley came in with a downgrade that hit the stock, and the stock had been moving lower and lower as it was. So it did base out right at the point where we believe it would base out for about a 9% profit in about a week. We will look to re-enter this position on a week tape. And if, in fact, we find that the stock does move up and recapture some of its losses for people who are just buying out there. But this still looks like a very interesting position to be on the short side of. At the same time, I mentioned Lumber Liquidators. Interesting. Tesla is something that we have to talk about, because there's a piece out at the end of the day on Friday from Citron. Citron is a firm that specializes in quote-unquote research and does all sorts of hit jobs on companies, and they have a lot of followers. And when they say something, oftentimes you do see stocks moving. Now, they came out with all their reasons why, at this point, never before really have they come out with an idea or a recommendation or a piece on shorting Tesla at these levels. You know, this has been a pretty substantial momentum stock, or a MOMO, we call it, for some time. And even though it looks like the fundamentals don't match the pricing right now, the question is it going to match it in the future with some of the things that are going on? But there's a lot of really questionable items that are in the story right now, inclusive of their guarantee 50% buyback program. You know, what happens if they use cheaper batteries, and if, in fact, the 50% buyback program is going to be good for them because they're going to be essentially selling cheaper cars. And the valuation then goes down. And on top of that, there is some, there was a lot of, as I mentioned, one-time assets and revenue pushes into the last earnings report. If you look at what happened, there was, I think, three different components that were added back into the plus side versus expenses on the last report that I really wonder if they can do that again and how they're going to do that again. Things that, like they say, are one-time items. And if they don't have those one-time items, the earnings don't look so good. Not at all. So Tesla, I would watch the stock. Now, what we've seen is the stock sell off many times, 3%, 4%, 2% in a day, and then by the end of the day, it's pretty much flat or up. We're at, I think, close to or at an all-time high on the stock now. And I'm really curious to watch what effect, if at all, the Citroen note has on the stock. And there's a couple other players that have price tags in the like $25 range. Not $225, but $25. And then, if you think that there's a little bit of froth in the markets, well, you have no further to look than the IPO of Candy Crush. That's right. You may play it. You may love it. I like it. And Candy Crush is actually owned by a company called King, and they're going to be doing an IPO, and it's currently valued to somewhere like $5 billion. It's a one-hit wonder. It reminds me of a worse case than Zynga, because in the gaming universe, the players are finicky. They'll play a game, they'll love it, they'll buy things, they'll buy, you know, a bunch of in-product add-ons, and you know, they'll do all sorts of things. I mean, listen, there was a time when people were buying sheep and all sorts of feed for their Farmville animals. Where is that these days? Poor farm animals, probably dead virtually somewhere. I mean, they haven't been fed forever. And that was a Zynga product. And Zynga then also had a variety of other games. They had, I think, Words with Friends. They had some poker. They had a variety of things out there. And they were really very well attached to Facebook. Now, you have a company coming out with really essentially one game. Now, they do make good money. They make close to $1 million a day. But at the same time, how long will people stay with it? Is this going to be a one-hit wonder that IPOs and then just goes kaput? I think there's going to be a big craze because people like the game, and those people that like the game are going to want the stock and how that goes. But is it really a stock worth owning? And what are the potential pitfalls? And what are the potential problems if, in fact, this game loses its popularity for one reason or another? And you could yourself think about all the potential reasons why this will lose its popularity. It doesn't take a lot to kind of figure out, well, other games are out there. People just lose interest. It's repetitive. There's a whole bunch of things that come up. So I want you to watch for that. Put that somewhere in the back of your mind that to watch what happens with that IPO. Basically, I think the main thing that's going to be really shaping the week moving forward is all about what's going to happen with this budget. We've already seen that GDP is smack on where it looks like it was. We already see that a little bit of a slight slowdown and a drop in consumer confidence. We're seeing that hiring is still doing pretty well. We're seeing that there was some mixed data on housing, although we did see also that many of the home builders did come out with some very nice earnings and some reasonable outlook. So I think really what's going to be shaping things right now is this whole item of, hey, what's going on with the government? And it's going to be sloppy. both sides, on the up and the down. But if you think about really what happened here, the crescendo was the day that Bernanke came out and he said, you know, hey, we're not going to do anything here. We're not going to cut back on our bond buying. And the market screamed higher. Gold screamed higher. Everything was all happy, happy. And since then, since that peak, that day, markets have been coming down ever so slowly, but coming down. And each time the markets have been moving up, there was someone there selling, taking profits, and just, you know, bailing out a bit. So we're on a bit of shaky ground from a fundamental standpoint. Earnings season is around the corner, but yet there was some really negative outlook. I would be careful of some of the global providers of technology and technology services, particularly those that are very involved with governments. And I would also be looking at some of the consumer cyclicals. We saw some warnings that, you know, another weird story from Walmart last week, where there was a story that they're stopping or slowing down their purchases because their inventory is piling up. And then there was, you know, there was a rebuttal about that and saying, well, it wasn't exactly what we said. And who knows what's going on, because, you know, you have one side that's constantly trying to bang stuff down, one side in the news that's trying to bring things up. And it's a very hard market to discern if you're watching the news. So what do? You shut off the news. Right now is a time that you really want to focus on technicals. Fundamentals are important long-term, but right now you really need to be focusing in on the technical indicators for a stock or a market. And that's how we see it. Because once you get past a point of fundamentals on a total basis, when it comes to a market being reasonable, there's something else going on, and that usually is led by emotion, and that usually leads to a lot of volatility. And you could usually find places to be long or short, you know, markets or individual securities during that period. So just a point of reference there. Anyway, check out DH Unplugged this week. We're going to have some fun on that Wednesday morning. It comes out. Of course, we have the game that we're playing here, the contest closest to the pin, where you can actually go right now. And this week's stock, you can put your particular thought process of, okay, well, the price is going to be this when the contest closes this week. And there's some prizes. We're giving away a Trigger Point Research subscription, some books, all sorts of good things. So check out DH Unplugged or pick it up on iTunes. And, of course, Trigger Charts. We have that webinar on the 2nd of October at 11:30 a.m. I want you to attend that. I really do. It's going to be a good discussion of algos and algorithms. And if you've never looked at algorithmic trading before and you want to know more about kind of what it's all about and how the system creates the signals, well, we're going to talk about that then. Until next time, thanks for joining me. Andrew Horowitz. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.